This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Under Governor Walker's proposed biennial budget, K-12 education funding could face cuts its first year, the voucher school program could expand across the state, and school accountability could see some changes. But what do these changes mean for school districts in the Cooley region? Here to help us better understand the state budget's impacts on K-12 education are Randy Nelson. He's the School District of La Crosse superintendent, and Fran Finko is the School District of Onalaska's superintendent. So let's first talk about these proposed cuts to state support. I understand it'll be about $150 per student in the first year. So is there any sense as to how these cuts could play out in the school district yet? Randy, do you want to take a stab at La Crosse first?
Certainly. I think one of our big challenges here is that this is just a proposed budget, which I really hope means that there's still opportunity for input and dialogue and discussion before a final budget is done. However, we've calculated in the first year that as we try to account for a negative $150 per student, that reduction will cost us about $990,000, almost $1 million to make that up in that first year. And we're not inclined to carry it over or use our fund balance to do that. Our fund balance is not at the level we'd like it to be, so they're not the short-term borrower to make our payrolls. And so the other piece is that we don't want to carry over because we just don't know that we can trust that the year $2 will be there, given all the state revenue issues, et cetera. So the first year, minus $990,000, and we're not exactly sure how we're going to cover that at this point.
So as my next question, even though you don't know how you're going to cover it, I mean, I'm assuming you have to look at jobs, programs. Is everything on the table at this point?
Actually, everything's on the table. So you look at programs. We look at benefits and salaries. I mean, all of those pieces are out there. We've been doing that for several years in order to make our budgets meet in our school district.
And Fran, you sent out a letter to parents a little less than a month ago, and it said that in that first year's budget, it would be about $428,000 to Onalaska schools.
We've talked a little bit about it. You know, you have to plan, even though, like Randy said, it's absolutely just a proposal now, and we hope that the Democrats and Republicans get together. We talked a little bit about it this morning and how kids get one chance. You know, it's not a blue issue, a red issue. It's a school issue, school children. You probably have children. We have grandchildren. These are employees, future employees that are being trained now, and kids don't get a mulligan. You can't redo second grade or third grade, so we have to be really careful in what we do. We talked about attrition. We talked about savings from insurance programs. We talked about some program consolidations, and obviously there has to be some cuts too.
Do you want to share any details how that could play out? Well, when you talk about program consolidation?
Well, we're not really there yet, and we're not to the point where we would be throwing it out on the table, but you have to look at all options.
So in that first year, you know, it could see a cut, but what does that mean for that second year for school district funding, that second year of the biennial budget? Fran?
Well, the second year, the first year they're saying 150 less, the next year they're saying $165 more per student. So we basically get it back plus a little bit. But in the meantime, you have this divot, you have this big hole that you have to try to fill somehow without hurting, you know, programs and services and essentially kids' education.
So, Randy, does that mean that maybe the La Crosse school districts would cut back on things for a year but then bring them back?
Well, I don't know. You know what? There are so many things that we're taking a look at. There are pieces of programs and things that we ought to be doing and that we haven't been able to do. So there's always more things and programs for us to do with the money than there is money to help out with those things. So, everything is certainly on the table. We continue to talk about it. As I mentioned before, it doesn't appear that we're inclined to just go ahead and carry over that $990,000 knowing that we're going to get it back in that second year because we don't know if we're going to get it back in the second year. Everything's a proposal at this point. And so I think our general rule of thumb right now is we better account this one year at a time. It's really hard, in a lot of school districts, ours included, that it's really difficult to plan budgets over 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years because you really don't know what you're going to get from one year to the next. You really end up baseline just kind of going for the next year and figuring out what the next year looks like. So I anticipate that that we'll really take a look at some reductions here in this first year.
And these possible cuts come on top of about a decade's worth of decline in funding to K-12 education. Is there any way you can provide any sort of historical context about how this has impacted the different districts? Fran?
Well, I think if you look back, what school districts are used to receiving are a per pupil dollar amount increase, kind of an inflationary
Just to keep up with cost of living.
Exactly. And so there's three ways districts get money. One, new money, that's one way you get it from the state, and they say, okay, we're going to give you this inflationary figure. The other way is if you enroll new students. And the third way is if you bring students in through open enrollment. Well, you know, districts around here pretty much, there's only a few that are growing. Most of them are flatlined. And open enrollment isn't always a good thing to count on from year to year. So you look for, and the Constitution points that out, you look for the local people and the state people to say, you know, here's the money to help run your schools. That's their obligation, and that's what we hope they help us with.
And Randy?
Also for us, I'd really like for us to be able to provide our employees with Consumer Price Index urban figure of 1.62% pay increase. The cost to do that for our employees is about $960,000. And so that, when you look at the fact we're going to have to reduce $990,000 in the first year, and we'd like to give people a CPIU raise of 1.62%, we've got almost a $2 million gap there to fill at the same time. And that does not include sometimes what happens with the uncertainties of health insurance, which we're still waiting to find out what kinds of increases we may have coming down the road. So there's so many moving pieces right now that it's even difficult for us to create some sort of a strong budget. We certainly have had discussions, as Fran has said, about some of the moving pieces. But they're big rocks right now, and we're trying to move them around to figure out how they fit together best.
When was the last time that staff, teachers, received pay increases in La Crosse?
Well, you know, for us, they did receive a slight pay increase last year. We were able to do the CPIU. But in years prior to that, I think there were two years in a row of a freeze, and then I think we did a 1%, even though we could have done like a 2.02. And again, that doesn't count health insurance kinds of things. We've changed our health insurance, I think, for three consecutive years, changed the health insurance plan so that it wouldn't cost as much and reduced our costs, our expenses that way. So it has been a pretty consistent job of adjusting downward in terms of the resources that we have to support our staff.
And Fran, what about increases in Onalaska? Have you been able to keep up with Consumer Price Index?
Or? We have, but I'll tell you, Maureen, it's a lot different than when there was a qualified economic offer, that 3.8%, where the 3.8% went for both health insurance benefits and insurance benefits and salary. And when Act 10 came through, it became the Consumer Price Index that Randy was talking about. And for the last 3 years, our people have been able to get that Consumer Price Index increase. But it doesn't take into consideration any longer any increases in health insurance benefits or any type of other ancillary insurances that you provide. We're not spending as much money for increases as we did in the past, but on the other hand, it's going strictly for salary and not for insurances anymore.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the proposed state budget's impacts on public K-12 education. My guests are Fran Finko, he's the superintendent of the School District of Onalaska, and Randy Nelson is the School District of La Crosse's superintendent. Another proposal that could impact your school district's budgets are the voucher school expansion program. It's what been in 2 years we've seen this in La Crosse. Mm-hmm. So, Randy, can you talk about how, you know, in these previous 2 years, how it's impacted the school district and maybe as we're looking forward, potential impacts on the budget?
Well, I have to tell you that it's really difficult to quantify specifically the impact that it's had to us because, quite frankly, we are not it's not as though the private voucher schools who are grabbing the voucher dollars with our students, it's not as though we always know who those students are because they don't have to share with us which of our students are in the mix in their particular programs. You know, I get really concerned about expanding beyond what it is. And the biggest concern I have is that the expansion is really at the cost of the public schools, whether you're Onalaska or whether you're La Crosse or whatever school district you might be exercising your voucher. Those dollars are somehow coming from the public schools, either directly because those dollars are attached to your name or indirectly because you haven't started school yet and now you want to go through a voucher system. Those dollars will come to some extent into a pool and they're going to be pulled from public education. And so it has a huge impact, not to mention, I think, some of the transparency issues that we have along the way. You know, our school district prides itself, so does Unalaska and other public school districts, of course, in being transparent with our budgets, having elected officials, you know, putting things out there and making sure that we're qualifying and adhering to the rules that we need to for transparency. And yet our voucher schools are not required to do that. The privatization pieces that sit inside of that would be one thing to just be against voucher schools, but to have those opportunities for students, it's not that bad, except when the accountability is just not the same. So that at the end of the day, when it comes time to determine whether these vouchers are working or not for students, there's really not going to be a solid way to compare apples to apples to see if it's happening. So that would be my starting salvo on this whole issue. It's a big concern that we have moving forward. Very big financial concern with what the state is doing with the dollars that could be going into the public education, which really are being pulled off and siphoned to really fund a second school system in the state of Wisconsin.
But Fran, what about the argument that parents and families should have a choice where their schools go?
Well, and you know they do now. They absolutely do now. There's public school choice. It's been around for a long time. The question is not so much about choice. The question is, should public school funds be for public schools? Should public funds be for public schools? Or should there be a check in every backpack and let them spend it where they want? I mean, it's obvious that people have a choice now to whether they want to go to a public or private school or whether they want to go to another public school in the area. There's vouchers. You know, if you go look back, Maureen, at why vouchers came into play in the early 90s in the first place, it was about allowing kids who are low-poverty students, a lot of them were minority students, to leave a failing school in the Milwaukee public schools to go to a private school where they might get a better education. It didn't do anything to fix the broken school, supposedly, the failing school. And all the students that got left behind in that failing school, it didn't do anything for them either. So if you think about the purpose of vouchers, and you were to take that money for vouchers and put it towards failing schools and making them better, wouldn't have to worry about any kind of special fund that takes from the public school and gives to the private or private charters. You wouldn't have to do any of that if you just focused on what the real issue is. If the issue is failing schools, of which I believe there's only 5% in Wisconsin that qualify under the accountability report card as failing, then let's fix those failing schools. You know, Randy hit on the accountability piece. If we're all going to get public school money, if there's going to be a backpack in everybody's backpack, then we should all be held to the same standard.
If voucher school program was expanded throughout the state, if this cap was lifted as Governor Walker's proposing, would that have an impact on Alaska? Or is it sort of like Randy, like, we don't really know?
Well, you don't know, and you don't, because you don't know how many of your students are leaving. Right now, when students leave through open enrollment, we are informed of that. We know who's going. We know where they're going. We don't hear that from the vouchers. I don't know if we'll be impacted or not. But overall, if the money comes from one pot, you know, if we're going to be directly impacted, but if it all comes from one public funding source, then we will be indirectly impacted, and that's not a good thing.
Randy?
Just to echo one of the things that Fran said here, and that is that we do have choice within the public schools now. We have the open enrollment program, which has been around for a long time in Wisconsin. And as a matter of fact, because of our geographic proximities with one another, Unalaska and La Crosse have several students who open enroll into each other's school districts. I think maybe Unalaska right now has 7 more students than we do. Vice. I mean, it's an option that parents already have, and they have wonderful school districts in this region, in this particular area. And I think choice is already there, and choice is already very solid. And to actually create this other program over on the side, I'm not sure that makes sense on a lot of different levels.
Both school districts, La Crosse and Unalaska, passed operating referendums recently. Is there any sense that the budget could impact the results of those, or are they the law of the land now?
No, I mean, here's what happens in Unalaska. Let me jump in. Our community gave us permission to exceed the revenue limit. All schools are held to this revenue cap, this revenue limit per pupil spending. If you want to have a better than revenue limit school district, you go to a referendum and your community says, we'll give you more money to operate. In our case, they did almost $2 million a year for 5 years. They give you more money for technology, $500,000 a year for 5 years. And then they gave us money to remodel, you know, two of our schools, $16 million. That was like that was like the best form of local control you could possibly have. But then the proposed budget comes out, and all of this local control saying we're going to give you these things so that we can have a better school district, that half a million or almost half a million, $430,000, that gets pulled right out of the mix. Hmm. So you had the community people saying, yep, we want to support you. 65% of our people supported the referendum on all three questions. And then all of a sudden, with one swipe of the pen, it could happen where we would have to cut $400,000 of that. And so now the voice of the people goes by the wayside because we need to balance a budget.
So essentially, either the proposals don't go through, or does that money just get shifted to other programs?
No. All of the programs will be in place. All the referendum questions will be, you know, we have the extra money for operating. We just have $400,000 less now for operating if that passes.
Okay. And Randy in La Crosse?
Well, you know, our community passed last spring a $22 million operating referendum, about $4.2 million a year for, I think, 5 years. And they've been very supportive of our schools, not to mention the new Northside Elementary School that we built here last year. But in a very similar way, you know, as we go out and we talk about operating referendum, we really are specific about how those funds would be used. And in our particular case, again, like Fran, using it for technology, we're using it to support lower class sizes, especially at our elementary schools. And so that's the premise under which we go out and talk to our community about how those dollars would be used. And then when the dollars don't come from the state side, it does put a strain on all of that because you need to remain committed to what you said that you would do with the community. And so at the same time, you're making reductions in other areas.
And Governor Walker has also said he wants to make it a priority to lower property taxes. And the way it seems that it's going to be playing out is about $5 per property annually. How does this impact school funding?
You know, let me say I think that one of the things that we have to be cognizant about is as you look at the education budget, when you ask people, well, what kind of money are you putting in the education budget? I can tell you that in that budget, there's $309 million that has been put into that budget. And person A is going to say, well, that's great. We're investing in our schools by $309 million or more. It's actually more than that. But the truth is $309 million is actually being invested not in education and not in programs and not in staff and not in the things we do with children on a day-to-day basis. But $309 million are scheduled to be used for tax cuts, property tax cuts on the backside of this on people's tax bills. And so, you know, one of the things that I'd be asking our legislators would be, take the $309 million that you're willing to spend on those tax cuts and put it inside of public education so that your schools can use it to better their programs and support their children better. If you're willing to spend it there, let's be willing to spend it here, especially if the impact is $10 per household each year or something like that. So I think we have to kind of get a feel for what that really means and what we're sacrificing when we really operate that way.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the proposed state budget's impacts on public K-12 education. My guests are Superintendent Fran Finko with the School District of Onalaska and Superintendent Randy Nelson with the La Crosse School District. So let's talk about school accountability. This seems to be sort of a hot topic this legislative session. The Assembly has put out its own proposal, but Governor Walker has put his own ideas forward when it comes to how to hold schools accountable. How do these new proposals differ from how you all are held to certain standards at this point in time? Randy, do you have any?
Well, you know, it's difficult to get to specifics because there's still so many moving pieces, you know, I think, at the Capitol. But I would go back to what we were talking about earlier, and that is that we really have to have an apples to apples. You know, this the whole accountability measure is coming through to ensure that there is something that people can accept for the voucher school dollars. Because as this budget goes forward and the vouchers are included in this budget, I think one of the things that they're trying to pass is the school accountability bill so that people who line up against the vouchers when it comes time to look at the budget, they'll be able to address most of their concerns by saying, we already passed this accountability bill. What are you worried about? 99% of all your concerns have already been taken care of. So there's really nothing to be worried about in this budget bill. Bottom line is we really need need to have apples-to-apples comparisons when it comes time to discuss how well these voucher schools are doing and students in those voucher schools are doing. That's a huge component of this. But the other thing that I would say is I think there really needs to be a strong lens shown through this whole issue of transparency when it comes to using public dollars for purposes and being public with budgets and being out in the public with regard to how we're using the public dollars. There's a significant amount of subsidy right now that's going into private schools, private religious schools, and private churches at this particular point. And I think that there needs to be, alongside of the accountability they're talking about now, a parallel accountability for those particular dollars and the programs that they're running with those.
And Fran, your thoughts on just the accountability issue? I mean, should lawmakers and DPI be analyzing you differently?
Well, I would say no, okay? If you're going to take public dollars, then you should have the same accountability measures as public schools. I mean, what do? We welcome all students. We give them the programs that they need so that they can be successful. That's number one. That's the number one difference. You would call for the same licensing requirements. You'd call for the same use of the same assessment, the same state test. You'd call for the same reporting those results like Randy was talking about on the school report cards, the district report cards. If it's a check in every backpack, then it should be the same accountability. If it's state funds for whatever school choice you want, then it should be the same accountability across the board. That means educating everybody. That means programming for everybody. That means accountability for everybody in the same way, not saying we're going to give you one of three choices of an assessment to take and then somehow psychometrically we're going to make all those things comparatively equal. Good luck with that. I mean, I hope if that's what they do, they're able to do that. But to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But accountability, if the money's going to flow, there should be the same accountability.
Another big proposal that could really shake things up in school districts is talks of eliminating the Common Core standards. And Fran, in this letter that you sent out to the parents, you expressed your concerns with that and how it could potentially be costly. But can you explain what does this mean for the average teacher? What does this mean for the average student?
The Common Core standards were well thought out. It was a well thought out way to raise the bar for a lot of states, and when originally 48 or 49 states signed on, it was because the governors called for that. The governors wanted something so they could compare apples to apples. So we get the brightest minds out there, and we get the even local people, as local as people in our area, have worked on the Common Core standards. And when we come up with a set of standards that we can write curriculum off of and that we can purchase resources so we can teach the curriculum in those lessons, and the bar is higher, and it's way easier to understand than the old model academic standards that Wisconsin had for the last, 20 years or so, 15 years. Common Core, right now the option for the Common Core is if you want to adopt it, you can. Well, that's the option that came to us in 2010. And our district, I know La Crosse districts in CESA 4, the 26 school districts around us, all adopted the Common Core. And so now we need to be – and we worked on those. We wrote curriculum for 3 years. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in resources on that. Our teachers have hundreds of hours of work into writing lessons and lesson plans and curriculum documents. And so for us to say the new assessment is no longer going to assess the Common Core or you can throw those out, where does the accountability lie? If we have to be held accountable by a report card which shows increasing student achievement and closing the gaps in growth over time, what are they going to assess us on? If the Common Core is an option, what's the state assessment going to address?
And they haven't decided what that assessment would be yet.
No.
From what I understand.
And that's another issue with the proposed budget. If we spend almost $10 million on a new assessment, why won't we use it?
And, Randy, is this something that the legislators can decide that they want to support, that, the governor and the legislators just do away with Common Core?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is to do away with the assessment. It's kind of a roundabout way to get it done because the assessment that's been built has been based on the Common Core standards. And so instead of fighting the battle to stop the Common Core standards, what they're saying is let's just take care of the assessment because at the end of the day, then that will also take care of the Common Core standards. You know, they can do what they want. What I have to say is that we plan to stay the course. We have invested ourselves tremendously in the great work that's been done by our educators. So is on last. And just about every school district in the state with Common Core standards. They're better than where we were before. They have teachers talking better with one another about expectations of children and how they meet those expectations. And so we plan to stay the course. The big question is going to be what's going to happen, what assessments are going to be used or what different assessments might be used in the future if they just do the one and done piece that they're talking about now with this assessment that's coming out this spring. What's next? Because really, if you're going to put some accountability on top of that, if you're going to hold districts accountable, if you're going to put consequences in for districts for not performing well, you also need to be able to be cognizant of what's on the test and set your students up and your district up to get the best results that you can. So we're going to stay with the Common Core. We're going to see what happens on this whole assessment front. But I would close with this comment and say, there are times I wish we could just step away from the state and say, you know what, you guys, when you've got this figured out, give us a call. Because what's happening is that the children in our classrooms and the staff in our classrooms are too important to take on this roller coaster that we've been on when it comes to standards and it comes to assessment and the work that we've done. It's very unfortunate that this is where we are. It is where we are. And what I tell our staff all the time is just focus on the children. Don't let the other stuff distract you at this point. Focus on children.
And Fran, will Onalaska schools stick with the Common Core?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. The old model academic standards gave us standards at the end of 4th grade, 8th grade, and 12th grade. And they said, you guys figure it out. What needs to be taught at every grade, you figure it out. And it was done by Wisconsin people. And when they created those documents, they tried to do everything for everybody. The model academic standards in Wisconsin, there's 501 model academic standards. There's some states that have less than 10. So that whole accountability, that whole national movement to bring things to some order, bringing the Common Core together, that was for a reason. And like I said before, it was driven by the governors. Randy's exactly right. What we have now is way better because it's by grade level learning outcomes. What is it that we want kids to know and be able to do by the end of kindergarten in reading, language, arts, and math? What do we want them to be able to do by the end of first grade? For us to write curriculum based on those grade level standards is way more meaningful, way more targeted than it was in the past. It really gives us a good handle on the instruction that needs to happen and the amount of resources and types of resources we need to purchase. So unless somebody can come up with a better way, like Randy said, the people have been putting their hearts and souls into the work here, our administrators and our teachers. For us to back off of something that's better than what we had, that'd be pretty foolish.
I want to end by asking you all about the fallout of Act 10. Some lawmakers and the governor have been touting how Act 10 has really saved school districts money. Has that really played out? I mean, is that something that you can tell has happened in Onalaska and La Crosse's school districts?
I can say for the school district of La Crosse, I'm not so certain that it saved us money. If it saved us money, I would say that about 90% of the money that has been changed or reduced has really come on the backs of our employees. Their take-home pay, that was dramatically impacted through Act 10 and the retirement. And I'm thinking about the changes in health insurance that have taken place along the way. The fact that what we can only negotiate at this time with our unions is the base wages. There's good in that and there's bad in that. The good in that is that sometimes it makes it pretty short negotiations. You know, it can be done in an hour. The bad side of that is that it opens up all those other pieces, all the other benefits pieces that our staff have had for quite some time. And when you have scarcity on resources, you're either going to cut the programs and raise class sizes for your children in your classrooms, or you're going to change the benefits for your staff. And we've done a little bit of both, but a lot of it has come on the backs of our staff. And it's time for them to get caught up and for us to move forward again.
And Fran, what about Nonalaska?
You know, I think what Act 10 did, probably the worst thing it did was it caused mistrust in people who trusted their government, trusted their leaders. And what that did was that carries over into school districts. If they can do this to me at the state level, what can we do at the local level? And if the message is all you need is two readings by the school board in a handbook, then we can change your benefits or we can change your salary or whatever, then that's a scary thing for teachers. And none of the districts I know around here did that to staff. They tried to keep some of the things in their handbook that were good. But I think it caused some mistrust. And now this is year four, and we're just starting to see people turn the corner. They want to work together. They want to be able to trust their school boards. They want to be able to trust their administration. They want to be able to trust each other. And I think people are now starting to do that. It was an act to get rid of collective bargaining. And so now where do we go from there? Post-Act 10 world is really different, but it's very important that we move forward in a positive way.
Fran Finko is the superintendent of Onalaska's school district, and Randy Nelson is the superintendent of La Crosse's school district. Today, we were talking about the proposed state budget's impacts on public K-12 education. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, a new book explores the history of La Crosse around the turn of the 20th century using postcards. To hear today's show or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. A recently released history book tells the story of the city of La Crosse through postcards that were produced around the turn of the 20th century. Laura Godin and Paul Beck are the authors of La Crosse. The book is part of a postcard history series that is produced by Arcadia Publishing. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Laura Godin why they chose to focus on the turn of the 20th century.
Basically, there was just a big change in La Crosse at that point in time because the city was taking shape. You know, city services were coming into play, and people were more aware of what they wanted their city to look like in the future. And so you could see what people valued, and you could see how these people of the past has really made our city what it is today.
There are a lot of postcards from that time to choose from.
Yes, yes.
That was a popular form of...
It was a postcard mania, they called it, back about 1910 to 1920. It was just such a popular way of communicating. For a penny, you could send the postcard. And we have examples of cards of where people are just sending a card in the morning reporting that they made the trip safely from Stoddard, Wisconsin to La Crosse. You know, I got here safely. See you tonight, or almost. It's just amazing.
Really? Yeah. Are there a lot of those in the collection?
Not a lot, but there are some that just show you the popularity.
Do you feel this is one of the most important and interesting time periods in the city's history?
Sure. Yeah, it's the heart of the progressive period. It's the growth of the modern city. It was a city beautiful movement. The first chapter is all about the parks. I think Laura should talk about that.
Why don't we talk about that now? Because the first one deals with city parks. And Laura, why don't you talk about that?
A lot of people, when they think about La Crosse and when they describe it to friends and relatives that have never been here, one of the first things that come out of their mouth is, well, it's a really beautiful area. And it's a city that takes great pride in enhancing the natural beauty, big tree-lined streets and lots of parks and nice parks. And when the city really got serious about starting a park system, they hired this guy named John Nolan. And the name might sound familiar to people because in Madison there's John Nolan Drive, of course. But he was a fairly famous landscape architect. And he designed a whole park plan for the city, and the crown jewel was Riverside Park. And people might not realize just how much, what a concerted effort it was to create a beautiful system of parks in La Crosse.
And really, the postcards from the early 20th century kind of reflect what Riverside Park looks like today. If you can envision trees much shorter back in that time period, But really, the parks are one of the fairly staple pieces of history around La Crosse.
A real showpiece. It was back then, and it still is today.
Yeah.
It just goes to show what a good job they did do planning the parks.
And Riverside Park is kind of an engineering marvel because that land didn't exist like it looks, today, that they actually had to dredge the river and fill that area in so they could have a really nice, spacious park right there.
I'm always struck by the tramway leading up to Granddad's Bluff, and I've seen that quite a bit, but people who look at this book may have never seen that before. We all think of Granddad's Bluff as another of the iconic images in the city of La Crosse, but it almost was not an iconic image.
That's right. That goes back to Ellen Hickson and her efforts to lead the effort to save the bluff, and it was heavily quarried. They did have a tramway. There's lots of fill from the bluff went into the river, building those wing dams, and I think basements perhaps, and roads.
The next chapter deals with people at work in the city, and it really tells quite a bit of the history of La Crosse from the early days of its formation, from being a trading post and having the Native Americans live here. And could one of you talk about that, Paul?
Sure. Well, we start off with the lumbering and how important that was. That really was the foundation of the city.
Right.
And that lasted for about 50 years, up to about 1900. And then there was a total and complete collapse of that industry with the cutting of all the timber. It was very sudden. I mean, within 4 or 5 years, the mills went from employing hundreds of people to virtually nobody. So then the city has to reinvent itself. I mean, there was always retail and trade, but they really had to go that into more and manufacturing. And there had been breweries, but now the breweries were ramping up because now they could distribute with railroads and refrigeration cars. So the breweries got more productive, and we have some nice photos of the brewery industry in here. There's one I really like, and I mentioned this one about the – there's we have one of the guns bottling department, and it's interesting because it's women that are in the bottling department, and that's what the postcard shows, about 8 women standing around tables as the bottles go by. And what's really interesting to us is that the message is actually in the front of the postcard, because this postcard is prior to 1907, and up to 1907, the post office required that the back of the card was only for the address and the postage. You couldn't write in the back, so you had to write in the front at the bottom of the card. And this particular postcard, the woman is writing to her friend, and she is proudly saying, "This is where I work, but in the office." So we think, you know, she's proud to work there, of course, but even more proud, perhaps, that she is an office worker and not on the bottling line. So we like that story.
This is a pre-prohibition history, look at history.
Yep.
And certainly the brewing history and taverns have always been a great part of the city of La Crosse's heritage. And how do you reflect that in this chapter?
Well, we have at least one image of a pre-prohibition bar, the Fountain. That's one of my favorites in there. And then we have, after Prohibition, we have another of establishments, long-time establishments in downtown La Crosse.
Well, we talked about the bodega. On that page, we talked about how they survived Prohibition, that originally, you know, everyone knows them as kind of the buffet, the lunch buffet. But originally, you know, they're selling beer and cigars, and then when Prohibition hit, they had to kind of change their business model in order to survive, so they started serving food, and that's what they became known for many, many years.
Another chapter deals with city people, from Native Americans who lived here to housing and some of the early sports teams and service clubs. And one of the photos I was drawn to, and I understand there's kind of an interesting story, are the go-drawn wagons with children in the back. Laura, could you explain why children had their pictures taken with goats
back in the day? That is an excellent question, and that's the same thing I asked myself the first time I saw them. I thought, this is really weird and bizarre. Like, who was this person that got this brilliant and bizarre idea? And then when I started to look into it, I found out it was actually like a nationwide trend, and it just became a popular thing to do. And if you think about it, if you're like a door-to-door guy taking photographs, you do need some kind of gimmick, because you can't just be like, oh, I want to take a picture of your kids. Like, well, okay, but, you know, there's nothing exciting about that. But if you had this goat and a wagon, you could see how little kids would be excited and be like, oh, mom and dad. And even mom and dad might think it's, you know, kind of a really neat, memorable experience. And if you Google, you know, kids and goats and, you know, old photos and things like that, a whole bunch will actually come up. So it wasn't unique to the area, but I found the images to be really striking, and it's nice to know that this trend did hit our area and people did participate in it.
Another chapter is the municipal services in the city of La Crosse, building a city. You have photos of historic, city hall, county courthouses, that type of thing. Any photos stand out from that section?
Well, we also have schools in there, I like one of the St. Wenceslas School. For one thing, it helps us. It helped us because they dated it. It's an interior shot of a class, and they have the blackboards in the background, and they have the date that this photo is being taken. We did research all the postcards, and we have captions in all of them, but some we're not sure the date or maybe the exact location. But here, this is helping us out. And what's also of interest to us as historians is they have the names of the students on the blackboard. And this was a school that serviced the Bohemian community, so most of the names on the board are Czech. And it just shows you a slice of ethnic history of La Crosse.
One of the things that stood out to me in that chapter was kind of how we've progressed as a society, the notion of a La Crosse County insane asylum, which there's one or two pictures of in that chapter, I think. And these days we've found more politically correct ways of describing how we take care of people.
Yeah. But at the time, what they were doing by building the sane asylum in La Crosse County, they thought was actually very humane. You know, it was part of the larger movement started by Dorothea Dix. And before this, you know, insane people were all housed in Madison. And so they thought it would be more humane to house people closer to their home so their families and friends could come visit them and they could be in more familiar surroundings. Now we know, you know, the treatment still wasn't always the best. And we have gotten better as a society, but I guess this was part of the movement to treat people with mental illness better.
And then the last chapter deals with kind of everyday life in La Crosse, things like fairs and festivals, recreation, ballrooms, taverns. What stands out in that final chapter?
I think it's fun. I think it's my favorite chapter. Just lots. I mean, it's people having fun and what we do to entertain ourselves. We have pictures of some taverns, some old ones, some. A ballroom, Avalon Ballroom, I think is one of our favorites. Laura, you can...
Yeah, I mean, it was just a lot of people have heard about the Twinkle Star ceiling in the movie theaters, but the Avalon Ballroom also had a Twinkle Star ceiling so people could dance under the stars. But not only are there fun things in this chapter, but that we also cover on some of the more disastrous things. Just because we consider this chapter to be one of memorable events, and the Twinkle Star ceiling at the Avalon was actually destroyed by a fire. But they rebuilt, and no one was hurt, and so it is kind of a story of rebuilding and continuing on and surviving disaster.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking with the authors of a recently released photo history book on the city of La Crosse. They are Laura Godden and Paul Beck, both special collections librarians and historians at UW La Crosse's Murphy Library. This is told mainly through photographs. There are lengthy captions that describe what you're seeing in the photograph. Why is telling a city's history visually such a good way to do it?
What's the old saying? A picture is worth 1,000 words, and postcards are very specific format. And yet there's writing in the back or in the front, and that helps us zero in on what the writer is, what's important to them. It just gives us some insight.
Yeah, the postcard's a very deliberate medium, and you don't just kind of create them on a whim so much. So you really are highlighting kind of the peaks of the city and what was important, what people valued, and what they wanted to show their friends and family. And so it is kind of interesting to think like, oh, you know, why are they sending a postcard with a picture, you know, the insane asylum or a disastrous fire? But it was such a means of communication, like Paul said earlier, just even like making social plans or informing people I arrived safe. You know, this is a time when the mail came twice a day. And people are always complaining now about cell phones and texting and how it's destroying our grammar and our you know, our sense of, you know, writing in a way that's a proper form of communication. But if you look at these complaints today about cell phones, they're the same complaints that the upper classes had about postcards, that there's a lot of shorthand and spelling mistakes. And the other thing I really like about postcards, it was a medium of the masses. Like, there was postcard mania, but it was for your average citizen. Like, the upper class, you know, kind of removed themselves because they thought the postcard medium was sort of, you know, a little bit of a lower rung, you know, that they're kind of above that. So,
was it easy to make a postcard back in this time?
That you needed a special camera. They had special cameras. And so the cost really depended on who was in your community and what kind of equipment they had. But if your community had someone that had the camera and had the paper, you know, it was within the reach of everyday people. But it wasn't definitely wasn't something that they did often. It still was a special occasion.
There were a lot of firms in Germany that specialized in making postcards, and some of the prettiest ones are from there. But that market died off, or that when World War I erupted. Mm-hmm. So there was an interruption in that. And the postcards we really like are the photo postcards, where it's an actual photo that's put on this postcard paper. And some of those are, you know, very revealing.
So, there's a division between, like, a commercially produced postcard that was for sale, like, at a drugstore or another place like that where they produce, like, thousands of them. Like, it might have a picture of the courthouse versus a picture of your kids in a wagon with a goat. And, you know, you still probably got a handful of them made to give out to friends and family, but on a much smaller scale. And it was a different type of printing and different type of process.
Are many of these postcards and photography in the postcards being published for the first time in this book?
No, I think this is the first time probably for the majority of them. There might have been some in some of the previous La Crosse history books, but...
Yeah, especially the real photo postcards that people got personally produced that were made in a lot smaller batches. Like, we're not sure how many of each copy survived. You know, we probably have some postcards that we have the only copy that still exists.
How is this book different from other history books about La Crosse?
Well, one is the medium. It's postcards only. And it is a specific time element from about 1890 up to about 1940. And then I think it's the research we put into it. You know, we're not just throwing postcards up on a page. We have selected them to tell a story, and we've researched each postcard as best we could. And we hope it's informative.
Yeah. I try not to rehash, you know, the things that people are already familiar with. Like, we put some background information, of course, so people had context and it made sense. But we really tried to focus on, because the postcard was such a medium of the people, so we tried to kind of focus on the story of average people, like what life was like for your typical La Crossean at the turn of the century.
I was struck when I looked through the book about how much of the history of La Crosse is still here. I mean, you can look at buildings and kind of know right where they are as you drive by them.
La Crosse is lucky in that we never had a major catastrophic fire that, you know, wiped out a portion of the city. Yes, we've had some very serious fires, but nothing, you know, huge.
Yeah, and the second part of where I was going with that is it also points out the fact we've lost a lot of the history over time. Can you maybe speak to that? How much history has La Crosse been able to preserve? How much has been lost? And how does it compare with other communities?
Well, What I think has been lost would be when I think of that is what's is along the old downtown, along Front Street, you know, with after the flood of 1965 and
right.
in urban renewal. You know, now I mean, we've got the convention center down there, and of course that's important, but those buildings were gone. We've lost, you know, the old courthouse and the post office or the federal building. And of course, that helps spark a preservation movement, which still continues today with the Preservation Alliance and other concerned folks. But what's been saved? Well, like, as I said, downtown La Crosse is still standing. The residential neighborhoods, I mean, you can walk around this town and we have such a varied architecture. It's just, you know, amazing from Italian to Federalist to Prairie style. So I think we're all pleased with that.
Mm. And we're definitely on the radar. You know, it won that Great American Main Street Award in 2002, the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And so we're doing better than a lot of communities. But yeah, there were some big losses I think people still regret today. But they also remind people not to be apathetic about the historic buildings in their community, that things can be lost. But one of the great things about our book is we highlight some of the groups that work together to make the community better and to save its history. And so concerned citizens can save historic buildings if they pay attention or are interested.
Laura Godin and Paul Beck are the authors of the book La Crosse, which examines the history of the city around the turn of the 20th century through postcards. They were interviewed by Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroub, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.